Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've sifted through the sources you send us, a really pertinent mix from financial reporters, Wall Street analysts, even some legendary investors known for their skepticism. So our mission today is to process all that and really get you up to speed on what's happening with this market tension. Because, you know, for months, it felt like markets were just running hot, hitting record highs, a lot of that fueled by, well, the incredible AI story. But then came this recent, pretty sharp drop, triggered by some geopolitical news. And suddenly all those old anxieties, you know, 1929, the dot-com bubble, they started feeling pretty relevant again.
Yeah, the whiplash is really something. And it forces the central question, doesn't it? Is this volatility we're seeing just, you know, market noise, maybe a buy-the-dip opportunity, or are we actually seeing symptoms of something deeper, a structural vulnerability? Is this boom maybe less about real growth and more of a, well, financial sugar rush?
Right. And we're digging into some serious sources to figure this out. We've got Andrew Ross Sorkin, who spent his career looking at financial crises. Plus, we're hearing alarm bells from people like Jeremy Grantham, Michael Burry. They're all drawing lines between today's AI hype, these sky-high valuations, and some regulatory changes, connecting them back to historical patterns of collapse. Okay, so let's start with the immediate trigger. What actually caused that recent dive?
It boiled down to trade wars, really. President Trump threatened a, quote, massive increase of tariffs on China. And this was a direct response after China put these pretty severe export controls on rare earth minerals, which, you know, are absolutely vital for U.S. tech manufacturing.
Ah, okay. So a direct tit for tat. How did the market react?
Immediately. And very specifically, the NASDAQ dropped about 2%. The S&P 500 fell maybe 1.5%. Both hit their lows for the session. But what's really fascinating, I think, is what came before that drop. Complacency. The S&P had gone something like 33 sessions without even a 1% moves either way.
33 sessions. Wow. So just coasting.
Pretty much. And the selling pressure, when it hit, was laser focused. It hit the names you'd expect. The ones with big China exposure. Think NVIDIA, Broadcom, Micron, AMD. That kind of sharp, concentrated reaction, it tells you the market was, well, priced for perfection, as they say. It seems like everyone was just focused on the AI story, maybe expecting Fed rate cuts and kind of ignoring these lingering risks like trade wars or even a potentially weakening labor market.
But almost immediately, the buy the dip crowd jumped back in, right? What's their argument?
Oh, absolutely. They point to what they see as strong underlying factors, you know, solid GDP growth around 3.8%. Consumer spending looks decent, although maybe a bit bifurcated.
Bifurcated.
Meaning it's largely being driven by the higher-end consumer, while others might be feeling more pressure. But yeah, the bulls also point to the AI revolution being real strong projected earnings for banks, like 12% growth expected, and, of course, the anticipation of the Fed starting to ease cutting rates.
Okay, so that's the optimistic case.
That's the buy-the-dip case, yeah.
Yeah.
But the counterpoint is pretty stark if you look at the data. Tom Lee highlighted the VIX, the volatility index.
The fear gauge.
Exactly. It spiked massively. It was actually one of the 51st largest spikes ever recorded. That signals investors weren't just selling, they were actively scrambling for protection, paying up for options. That's not just casual profit taking.
Hold on. If the VIX jump was that big, top 51 ever, doesn't that kind of punch a hole in the buy the dip story? I mean, massive fear suggests something's really wrong under the surface. Regardless of earnings forecasts.
It absolutely shows deep nervousness. You're right. Now, historically, a spike like that can sometimes mark an interim low.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that maybe all the panicked or forced selling gets flushed out, leading to decent short-term returns.
Okay.
But it also confirms that the complacency we saw before the drop was, well, incredibly fragile. The market is jumpy, prone to sudden fear. And that kind of environment is exactly what worries someone like Sorkin when he starts drawing parallels to the lead-up to 1929.
Yeah, let's talk about that structural risk. Sorkin's been saying current prices just don't feel sustainable, seeing these unsettling echoes of the roaring 20s before the crash. Can you walk us through that 1929 parallel? I mean, the basic story is famous, right? From 1928 to September 29, the market went absolutely nuts, up 90%. Then came Black Tuesday. And the cause often cited is this speculative frenzy, this sugar rush built on borrowing.
Exactly. And the key enabler back then was new firms of debt. You have to remember, before maybe 1919, using credit for everyday stuff, many people saw that as almost a moral sin.
Right.
Then General Motors really changed the game. They popularized installment plans so people could buy cars. Bankers saw that and thought, we can apply this model elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they applied it to the stock market, allowing regular folks to buy stocks on margin. You'd put down maybe just 10% of the price.
Only 10%.
Yeah, just 10%, and borrow the rest from your broker. And back then, just like sometimes happens now, this was sold as democratizing access, letting everyone get rich from stocks. When the market was soaring, that leverage felt amazing. But when it turned, that same leverage forced massive selling and made the crash exponentially worse.
So Sorkin's worry, essentially, is whether the hundreds of billions pouring into AI right now are creating a similar dynamic, a kind of gold rush or sugar rush that depends entirely on the optimistic story playing out perfectly.
That's the core of the anxiety. And what makes it worse, Sorkin argues, is that the protections put in place after 1929 seem to be weakening. He says the guardrails are tumbling down. Things like SEC disclosure rules maybe aren't as strict, and regulatory bodies might have less teeth.
Which leads right into this whole debate about democratizing risk, doesn't it? Historically, your average person couldn't just invest in, say, a hot AI startup before it went public. Those private markets were restricted. But now there's a real push, including from industry heavyweights like BlackRock's Larry Fink, to open up access to these riskier private assets. They've even talked about putting them into things like 401k retirement plans. Again, using that democratizing investing language, how would that actually work?
Well, the idea being floated is often to allow funds commonly found in 401ks, like target date funds, which are the default for millions to put a small slice, maybe 5 or 10%, into private equity or private credit. But here's the catch. Private companies just don't have the same disclosure requirements as public ones. Their valuations are murky. The assets aren't easy to sell quickly. They're illiquid.
So less transparency, harder to get your money out if you need it.
Exactly. And the risk is pretty clear. Look, diversification and a long time horizon are good things. But putting illiquid, less regulated, potentially riskier bets into the very accounts designed to be your safe nest egg, that introduces a systemic risk. It feels a bit like the leverage issue in 1929, just wearing a different disguise, the disguise of access.
And we see how that speculative mindset can get twisted today, just using modern tech. Sorkin shared this wild story. He was on TV with Larry Fink, who made an offhand joke, something like, there should be a Sorkin coin. Just a joke. But within hours, some speculator actually created a cryptocurrency, a meme coin, named after Sorkin.
Seriously?
Yeah. And this coin, based on absolutely nothing but hype and probably manipulation, apparently hit $170 million in trading volume in a single day before crashing almost immediately.
Wow. $170 million on a joke coin.
It just shows how fast speculation can run wild now, especially if the guardrails feel weak.
That Sorkin coin anecdote is kind of a perfect, if scary, illustration of how quickly speculative bubbles can inflate today. And that fever is really amplifying risks in probably the most critical area right now. This AI concentration problem. I mean, look at the S&P 500. It's supposed to be your diversified index, right?
Right. The benchmark.
But the tech sector now makes up over 35% of it, and it's dominated by just a handful of giant companies all chasing AI.
Yeah.
The concentration is, frankly, staggering. Since late 2022, something like 75%, three quarters of the S&P 500's total return has come just from these AI-focused stocks. And NVIDIA, the main chipmaker for AI, is now 7% of the entire index.
7%, just one company.
One company. Think about the impact that has on millions of people who just passively invest in index funds. Their fortunes are incredibly tied to just a few names.
Okay, but I have to push back a little here. Isn't it possible this concentration is just, well, efficient? The U.S. does have the world's most dominant, innovative tech companies. Is it really fair to compare this to, say, pre-1929 when the whole economic structure was different?
That's a really fair challenge. And the answer, I think, comes down less to the quality of the companies. Many are excellent. And more to the price being paid for them. You can absolutely overpay, even for a great company. And we have some pretty stark quantitative measures suggesting that might be happening now. If you look at the total U.S. stock market value relative to the size of the economy GDP, it's often called the Buffett indicator. Right now, it's sitting over 120% higher than its historical average.
120% higher than average. How does that compare to past bubbles?
Well, get this. During the peak of the dot-com mania, that same indicator topped out at around 55% above average. We are way beyond that now, almost double the dot-com peak overvaluation by that measure. And that's why you hear someone like Jeremy Grantham calling this a bubble within a bubble. That's why Michael Burry is betting against the AI hype. They think the prices are just fundamentally out of whack.
Even Bill Gross, you know, the bond king, he's worried too, warning that if these massive investments in AI infrastructure don't actually generate the expected profits soon, trillions in market value could just vanish, go poof, as he put it. It really drives home that dot-com lesson, doesn't it? A great story, real innovation, but bought at the wrong price. Cisco is the classic example.
Exactly. Cisco Systems. Since the year 2000 peak, Their revenue's up 4 times. Profits are up 5 times. By any measure, a fantastically successful company.
But the stock price?
It has never even gotten close to its peak price from back in 2000. It just proves the point. Real innovation can absolutely exist inside a speculative bubble. But eventually, valuation matters,
right.
Price matters.
Right.
And that brings us to this concept of mean reversion. History is pretty clear on this. When you see extreme market concentration like the U.S. tech dominance today, or maybe oil stocks in the 70s or Japan in the 80s, it always eventually reverts back towards the average. The huge winners cool off, and money tends to flow towards the things that were ignored or undervalued.
Okay, so wrapping this all together, what does this actually mean for you, the listener, trying to navigate this environment? What's the practical takeaway from this deep dive?
We're definitely not saying you should hit the panic button. Discipline over the long term still works. Things like dollar cost averaging, just investing steadily over time, regardless of market highs or lows, that's still a sound strategy. I mean, think about the QQQ, that tech-heavy NASDAQ 100 ETF.
Right.
Even if you are unlucky enough to invest right at the absolute peak of the dot-com bubble in 2000.
Which was a terrible time to invest a lump sum.
Right. But even then, if you held on, you still would have averaged about 14.5% per year over the next 25 years. So long-term discipline does pay off. Absolutely. But discipline also means being really careful about throwing extra cash into the market when valuations are stretched, you know, 120% above their historical average. The best advice usually comes back to basics. Focus on companies with solid fundamentals you can actually verify. Look for manageable debt, predictable cash flow. Because in the long run, it's the cash flow and the fundamentals that drive returns, not just short-term popularity or hype.
And maybe keep an eye out for that market rotation we mentioned. The best opportunities often aren't the most popular ones at the moment.
That's right. History suggests that after these big concentrated runs in large cap tech, money often flows into areas that have been left behind, like small cap stocks, for example. They tend to outperform when the giants finally stumble or just pause.
Okay, so to sum it up for you, we've seen that this recent market dip wasn't just about tariffs. It's happening against this much heavier backdrop. Historic levels of market concentration really stretched valuations. And these regulatory guardrails seemingly being taken down, often pitched as democratizing risk, which ironically is often how speculative bubbles gain the fuel to become systemic problems.
Yeah, and the key lesson that really comes through from all these sources is that real, potentially world-changing innovation like AI can exist right alongside or even inside a speculative bubble.
Yeah.
So the critical question for you as an investor isn't really, is AI real? It's more like, will the future returns actually justify the incredibly high price that the market is demanding for that future today?
And let me leave you with one final provocative thought to chew on. Something Andrew Ross Sorkin said quite pointedly, we will have a crash, I just can't tell you when. Now, combine that certainty with reports that some top CEOs are apparently very scared to speak out publicly right now, maybe fearing literal backlash or more regulation. What happens to market confidence, to that structural stability, when the very people who might offer crucial context choose silence instead? Something for you to mull over.